A joint hearing of the Capital Investment Committee and Environment, Finance, and Policy Committees for February 28th is called to order. I just want to welcome Chair Hansen and members of the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee today. Chair Hansen and I thought that it would be helpful to bring the committees together for an overview of PFAS as it relates to our infrastructure. And so with that, I will turn it over to Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Today we're going to hear about the status of the 3M settlement. Although it seems like just a little while ago, it's actually a few years ago, and many members were not here when that occurred. And we're also going to hear about the multi-state settlement, which is more recent, and how other states are addressing PFAS infrastructure. Members, please seek recognition from Chair Lee or myself for questions, and you'll be called upon at the end of each presentation. So let's get started. Welcome Special Assistant Cerdo. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Special Assistant Attorney General Peter Cerdo of AGO's office. In my work at the AGO's office, I'm in the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, and I represent DNR and MPCA, as well as the AGO's interest in the 2018 settlement with 3M. And I also represent MPCA on a variety of other PFAS-related matters. I was asked to come today and give a brief overview of the status of the settlement, which goes back in time, actually all the way into the 80s, and I'll get to that in a moment, as well as what's called a multi-district litigation in the District of South Carolina. That's a federal court process where lawsuits that are brought around the country are pulled into one central location, in this case South Carolina, to be administered as a group because so many of them are alike and have commonalities that can be more efficiently pursued through this MDL process. So backing up a little bit to the history beginning in the 80s, there were several sites in our East Metro area of the Twin Cities where we were aware, at least two of them, there was a problem with VOCs being emitted. These were waste sites where 3M had dumped manufacturing waste. And so beginning in the 80s, these sites were being brought into our environmental programs to address those VOC problems. There was also a waste site in Woodbury where 3M had disposed of its industrial waste and had a variety of pumping stations that were being used to bring up groundwater. That groundwater was used in their industrial processes and then being discharged into the Mississippi. Starting in the early aughts, around 2002, we were beginning to see PFOA and PFOS, which are two of what I'll call the legacy long-chain PFAS analytes, coming out of those sites and being detected in the groundwater. So that kicked off a request, or actually specifically a MERLA work, that's Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act, where 3M stepped up to do a lot of work to assess those sites and figure out what was going to be needed to address the PFAS that the state was seeing in the groundwater. That work ended up culminating in a 2007 document that we call the SACO, S-A-C-O, for Second Amended Consent Order. That SACO required 3M to do a variety of evaluations and come up with a plan, and it reserved the state's rights to pursue other remedies, most notably NRD, or Natural Resources Damages. Fast forward to 2010, the state filed a lawsuit in the name of the Attorney General at that time, Lori Swanson, as well as the commissioners of DNR and the Pollution Control Agency. And that complaint was a natural resources damages complaint against 3M for the damages of PFAS to the environment in the East Metro. That lawsuit went on for approximately 8 years until 2018. It was settled in February of 2018 on the eve of trial. The settlement amount for that case was $850 million, which I've learned was actually the third largest natural resources damages settlement in the history of the country after the Exxon Valdez oil spill and the Deepwater Horizon blowout. Now, there was a private law firm that the AG's office had retained to represent the state as part of that settlement. We received its fee out of that, but once everything was said and done, the corpus of that grant fund was well over $700 million. So PCA and DNR formed a task force to determine the best ways to implement the grant fund. The way that 2018 settlement was structured was that the dollars provided to the grant fund would be used in a descending order of priorities, the first of which would be to provide for clean drinking water in the East Metro communities affected by those dumps that were releasing PFAS that we were finding in the groundwater. So that first priority is going to end up taking the lion's share of the entirety of that grant fund. I will point out that even at $850 million, that does reflect a settlement amount. It was amount that the parties agreed to exchange to avoid the risks of litigation. And even at the time, it was understood that it might not be enough, or was known to not be enough, given the scope and need that we were going to have to address. Since then, and this is true across the board, we've learned more about PFAS in general. And when I say PFAS, I'm talking about PFAS, which is a categorical term for all of these fluorinated compounds. Our understanding of those is continuing to evolve. The health risks are continuing to become more well-documented. And the levels that humans should be exposed to are continuing to be ratcheted down by both our Department of Health and by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. So while we've been planning to address these things using the grant fund, we are also continuing to be aware that the level to which we need to treat the water to make it fit for human consumption is going to become more and more stringent. So in 2018 through 2021, the joint members of that task force established what MPCA and DNR called the Comprehensive Drinking Water Supply Plan. That's specific to those East Metro communities that need the water treatment to address the PFAS from the dumping activities. That Comprehensive Drinking Water Supply Plan has accounted for or budgeted every dollar of the grant fund and then some to deal with the need to do capital build out, largely filtration or other treatment systems. The primary ways that we deal with PFAS is with activated carbon, reverse osmosis, and ion exchange. And different types of PFAS react differently to different treatment methods, so it gets a little bit complicated. If I tried to go into the details there, I'd get quickly out of my own comfort zone. But these are all things that communities need to look at putting in to address the PFAS that they're seeing in their groundwater systems. In the meantime, even after Minnesota had put its own case to bed, there are a number of public water systems, municipalities, sovereigns like other states, that filed their own lawsuits against not only 3M, but DuPont and a host of additional PFAS manufacturers for PFAS contamination in their own water systems or states. By and large, these cases were all removed to this MDL I referenced at the beginning of my comments in the District of South Carolina. Those cases were originally brought into the MDL because they had claims against what is called AFFF, or aqueous firefighting foam. It's one of the main categories that we see for groundwater contamination of PFAS. Those AFFF cases, as well as cases that went beyond AFFF, were generally being assigned to this court in South Carolina. There are a few exceptions. Maine is one of them, where it was able to keep part of its cases in its own state court system. But in general, just about everything PFAS or PFAS adjacent was getting put into the South Carolina MDL. Now, there's a lot of stuff happening there. One big chunk of it, though, is what I will call the public water systems case. Those public water systems would be independent water systems that are not states or sovereigns and that have the capacity to sue or be sued in their own name. There was, last summer, announced two big settlements involving the DuPont entities and 3M. The DuPont entity settlement was a class action settlement, I can get to that in a second, to the tune of about $1.5 billion. The 3M settlement was also a class settlement that is valued somewhere between $10.5 and $12.5 billion nationwide. Now, the way class action works is it will define the members of the class. There are class representatives that are involved in litigation, but most class members are not party to the case. Instead, the class settlement will define who the beneficiaries are supposed to be. In this case, it was all of these public water systems. And then there's a process by which they will receive notice that they are a class member, and it will give them an opportunity to object to the terms of the settlement or to opt out of being a class member. So once those settlement agreements went out, or were finally approved by the court, the notices went out, the deadlines for the state, sorry, for the public water systems to either stay in or opt out have now passed. I do not have available to me today a list of those public water systems in our state that stayed in the class, that objected, or that opted out. That information is not available to me. I did call the class administrator earlier this week as I was preparing to come and talk with you all, and they said that that information was not available to be shared. I have interfaced somewhat with our League of Minnesota Cities. I know that Craig Johnson is somebody who's deeply involved in their individual decisions. I'm aware anecdotally of some of the municipalities here in the state that might have had concerns and that I suspect did opt out, but I wouldn't be a primary source for that decision. The point is, at this point, the judge overseeing the MDL has approved, finally, the DuPont settlement. And I checked on Monday, and as of February 26, 2024, that court has entered a final order in judgment. So the DuPont settlement is more or less put to bed as to the public water entities that are defined members of the class. The 3M final fairness hearing will be taking place at a hearing on March 1st, 2024. That hearing will also cover what the MDL is going to do with the state claims and the personal injury claims that are still pending in the MDL. So there's a lot of work left to do within that MDL. That's sort of the status of our agreement with 3M. I will point out that our comprehensive drinking water system, comprehensive drinking water supply plan today is well underway. Municipalities that have benefits under it are doing the build out for the capital infrastructure that they need. And that's going to continue. There's no municipality or public water system that has started receiving funds from the class action settlement yet, but they will. 3M, in particular, that's that largest one of $10.5 to $12.5 billion, has 10 years to make payments under that settlement agreement. So it's a relatively long-term payout. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I can update you. I've got you all the way through what's coming up on March 1st, and I'm happy to take questions based on everything I've shared so far.
Attorney General Cerdo, do you think that that list of the opt-ins and the opt-outs will become available? Is that likely that we would be able to see that at some point?
I think so. One of the things that has been happening in that litigation is that the special there's an entity appointed called the claims administrator that's in charge of getting notices out and then collecting up the responses. The docket is full of a bunch of back and forth between that claims administrator, the court, and the parties going through where there might have been errors in the opt-out forms, there might have been missed deadlines, and there could have been other problems. So the administrator was looking for guidance on how to sift through those, and I think that just isn't quite put to bed yet. I also don't know how well done the notice and opt-out process was. I have heard from my counterparts in the state of Connecticut, for example, that the two largest water systems in that state had not received notice of either one of the class action settlements in the first place. So I haven't been able to validate how well covered our public water systems were in terms of even receiving notice. My understanding from League of Minnesota Cities is that it was pretty comprehensive.
Special Assistant, regarding the opt-out and whatnot, you know, once they go through that whole process, Do you know if OBI made public the reasoning why someone may opt out or not?
No, but I will share anecdotally that there was one municipality here in Minnesota that knew it had a price tag of what it thought it needed to build out of about $69 million. This was a municipality that was not initially covered in the comprehensive drinking water supply plan for the grant fund. That $69 million bill was staring them in the face. That municipality went and plugged its well information and contamination information into an estimator that the class action made available. And it's based on the flow rate and the volumes and the types of analytes that they're seeing. That estimator told the municipality that it could expect to receive something like $3.5 or $3.7 million from the class settlement with 3M. So my understanding is that even though there is money available through the class settlement, it is not going to be enough to cover what we think the needs might be. In that particular example, we're talking about 5% of the total need.
And so just to that point real quickly, so is that a 5% cap at the total need? Is there a cap at all, or is it just mostly more going through the estimator and then they will figure it out?
Yes. So to be clear, this $10.5 to $12.5 billion figure is divided up between two tranches of plaintiffs. The first one is public water – I shouldn't say plaintiffs, class members. The first group of class members are those public water systems that have had a detection of PFAS already. The second tranche is public water systems that have not yet discovered that they've got PFAS or detected it, but are required to continue looking for it under an EPA requirement called UMCR5. So we've got those two groups of class members, but nationwide, the dollars that are coming in, the $10.5 to $12.5 billion, is going to be divided up first by paying off the attorney's fees, which is a fee application that the class action attorneys are going to request. There's a few municipalities that are in first place to get their claims paid first, and then everybody else has to split what's left amongst the class members. So it's not a percentage of whatever need is identified. It's what's available from the corpus of that settlement fund.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Chair Hansen.
Attorney General Cerdo, you mentioned the consent order from the early 2000s, and then we have the settlement of 2018. Can you maybe describe the difference? Does the consent order have requirements in addition and above the requirements that are in the settlement?
Yes and no. And I'm sorry to give you a lawyerly answer, but let me just explain what I'm talking about. The SACO from 2007 requires 3M to assess and provide treatment of water for three dump sites, and particularly to get the health value of that water to below what's called an HI of 1. The 2018 grant fund for $850 million is for the dollars that go into the grant fund. The SACO is open-ended in terms of how much money 3M has to spend. The interplay of these was that 2007 SACO was in place under MRLA in 2010 when we filed the NRD complaint and in 2018 when we settled the NRD complaint. So what the 2018 settlement says is we are going to enter into this agreement, we're going to fund the grant fund to the tune of $850 million for 5 years while we're figuring out what we need to do in terms of the capital build out, in terms of O&M, all the information that ends up going into that comprehensive drinking water supply plan. We need time to do that. So for the first 5 years while that's getting figured out, there's a temporary fund of up to $40 million to spend on temporary measures. And we could spend the 5 years on those while those temporary measures are being funded under that separate chunk. After that 5 years, everything that should have been paid for under the SACO is going to be paid for the grant fund. So from 2024, which we are now in, forward, the grant fund is paying for everything, SACO and 2018 settlement. And then once the settlement is fully depleted, the SACO comes back into effect, and 3M still has those obligations.
And follow. So then the SACO, when it comes back, but that only affects the three dump sites that were, and those three dump sites were where?
Oakdale, Cottage Grove, and Woodbury. There's a fourth site that we do have PFAS detection that is related to 3M waste. That's Washington County. That landfill is part of the closed landfill program and is administered by the state.
And then you had mentioned that it was natural resources damages. So with the settlement in 2018, we've learned, since 2018, we've learned a lot more on human health impacts. Is it possible for future liability for 3M to deal with human health impacts rather than natural resources damages?
So the settlement is, this was a natural resources damages complaint. The settlement contains a common clause at the end of it that you would see in just about any settlement agreement called a release. And that's when one party that's entering the settlement agreement says, I'm releasing the other party from certain claims. That release covers not only natural resources damages claims, but also any new claims that might rise under MRLA, statutory authority, common law authority, or any other claim that the state knew of or was unknown as of the date of the settlement agreement. So to answer your question, any new claims that have arisen since February of 2018 are not covered by that release. Any claims that pre-existed February of 2018, I wouldn't want to comment one way or the other as to how those would have to be sorted out.
So just in summary, we have the consent order from 2007, and then we have the 2018 agreement, and now we have DuPont has settled, and we're waiting to see what happens with 3M settlements, and then that may be available for our communities. Some may be available, and some may still choose to litigate for the damages on that on their own.
All of that is correct.
And when we're being asked to fund PFAS remediation for communities, is there any? So how would that come? Let's say with the DuPont settlement, because that's agreed. Let's say hypothetically, the city of Newport has contamination and they were in that settlement. How does that money come if you have X amount of dollars that it would cost and Y amount of dollars that comes from the settlement?
Yes. So if we were going to do it, if we were going to straight line that example I gave of $69 million versus $3.5 million, whatever dollars, and I should point out that the DuPont settlement is 10% of the 3M settlement. So we're not talking about, we're talking about significant dollars, big picture, nationwide. There's a huge, you know, the headline says $12.5 billion, right? That's over 10 years, that's nationwide. You got to divide that out. I'll point out that our settlement in 2018 covered basically one county to the tune of $850 million, right? So I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but it is bad news that there just isn't enough dollars available from the manufacturers of these compounds to cover the need that we now have as a society to deal with the PFAS problem that exists. When this settlement was entered with 3M, one of the main themes from the court, Judge Gergel in South Carolina, as well as the plaintiff's lawyers that were negotiating it, was $10.5 to $12.5 billion was pretty good considering. I think at the time 3M's market cap was $44 billion. And they're all very, very concerned, rightly so, with the potential for bankruptcy. A lot of these same lawyers and law firms had experience in opioid litigation, where there are entities that are still in bankruptcy today for whom states and other plaintiffs have seen not one dime, because that proceeding is tying up their ability to pay. So the calculation that was made for that public water system settlement was that $12.5 billion was a good result to make sure that it was something that 3M could fund and that would be available to public water systems right away, although over 10 years for the total payout. I'll also point out that that doesn't resolve all of the claims that are still pending, including the states and sovereigns that are in that case.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming. So, given your statement about bankruptcy, and I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, and I don't know if you are, but do you know whether this amount would be dischargeable in bankruptcy?
I do not.
Okay. Are you concerned about that?
Yes. It could, right? Right now, the operative theory is that this is an amount that 3M can pay and that it will be able to remain liquid and solvent and to fund. And that was one of the purposes of entering into the settlement that they did in South Carolina.
Thank you, Chair.
So, Special Assistant, being from Minneapolis, when I went through the docket just to look for myself, Minneapolis was listed as an eligible claimant. And I do want to note that when I reached out to Minneapolis, they did mention that as of date, there's no PFAS issue. And so can you just walk through, even though the difference between being an eligible claimant and if these entities actually have PFAS or not, too, just so that members of the public understand what being part of that class action actually mean or whatnot?
So for municipalities that have not yet detected PFAS, but they have to be serving at least, I think, 3,000 individual households. They will continue to get reimbursement from the class fund to monitor for PFAS. Another looming issue that is true of Minneapolis and other public water systems is the extent to which they treat wastewater. There is a concern over the residue that, you know, they've got filtration systems that are going to collect up PFAS. And then the question is, what do we do with that? And is that going to be considered a hazardous waste? And are they going to be able to have some sort of protection as somebody who's a responsible party? That has not been resolved yet out of this class action. But for Minneapolis, it should be able to stay in the class. It should be able to receive the class benefit. And that will be reimbursement for monitoring.
Thank you. Chair Hansen.
So from an infrastructure point, we traveled around the state. We visited many locations. They're asking for PFAS abatement. If we fund state dollars into wastewater or drinking water and there's waste created because of filtration, so that, you're saying that the city may be the responsible party or the state if we're providing the material?
There is currently pending a proposed rule from EPA that has not been finalized that would classify 9 PFAS analytes as hazardous. And so there is a concern there by wastewater treatment systems.
Members, any additional questions? Chair Hansen.
Just to be clear, I think when you receive the opt-out, opt-in information, we'd like that for our committees so we can see what our communities are when you get that.
Of course.
Thank you.
And so thank you, Special Assistant, for coming before us. Right now, we'll transition over to our Zoom testifier so you can leave. Members, I just do want to know, relating to that last piece, if you recall that conversation when we were in Woodbury and how they're dealing with that issue of waste and whatnot, if I recall, 13 truckloads going to the state of Ohio to be burned. And so I think that that's an issue for us to consider as we think about some of these local requests and also the requests from the agencies that we'll be bringing forth before us. So right now we'll turn it over to a Zoom testifier, Gretchen Salter from Safer States. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much. As you said, my name is Gretchen Salter. I'm with Safer States. Can I share my screen for a presentation, or would you prefer I just speak?
Yes, please proceed with sharing your screen.
Thank you.
And members, you do have the handout in your folders too.
Great. So thank you so much for inviting me here today. I am with Safer States. Oops, sorry, my slideshow isn't quite loading. As you see, I have the wheel of death on my screen, so give it a moment. Thank you. Okay, here we are, Gretchen Salter, Safer States. For those who aren't familiar, Safer States is a national alliance of state, local, and national groups working on trying to eliminate toxic chemicals from our environment. But we also track what states are doing on various policies as they relate to toxics. So we've been tracking PFAS policy throughout the country, really since 2017, when the when scientists started sounding the alarm on PFAS as a class. So we started looking to see what states are doing. And so I was asked to testify here today to talk about what states have done regarding PFAS, both on policy and also on infrastructure. So very quickly, it sounds like everybody here knows why we're focused on PFAS, but for those who don't, PFAS are a class of over 15,000 different compounds. Scientists started noticing that PFAS was contaminating a number of different sites, number of different drinking water sites around the country. Right now, the most recent investigation we have has found over 3,000 contaminated water sites around the country. It's estimated that more than 200 million Americans have PFAS in their drinking water systems. I want to point out right now that this map that we're looking at really is only looking at water. It's not looking at sludge, which we see is a massive source of contamination. It's not looking at soil. It's not looking at air. This is really just drinking water. The CDC has estimated that 99% of Americans have PFAS in our blood, and PFAS are found all over the globe. They travel on air currents, and they have been found in the Arctic. In fact, a recent study found over 60 tons of PFAS are in the Arctic. The reason we're concerned about PFAS, as has been stated before, there are a number of different human health outcomes linked to PFAS exposure, including cancer, birth defects, infertility, pregnancy complications, mostly preeclampsia, and a decreased immune response. And the more scientists look at PFAS and its effect on human health, the more they find. So this is really just a snapshot of what PFAS can do. They are called forever chemicals because they don't disappear in the environment. They do not have the ability to break down in the environment on their own. And they can transform, but they stay there forever, and they stay there forever in us. So starting in 2017, states have really been leading the way on PFAS. Thus far, we have 28 states that have adopted PFAS policies. They include things from water to restrictions on PFAS in consumer products and accountability. So here's a map of states that have taken action on PFAS. The big product categories that have been regulated in PFAS include food packaging. So that includes both paper-based food packaging as well as plastic food packaging, because we've now learned that PFAS can be used to make plastics. Eight states have adopted restrictions on PFAS in carpets and rugs and aftermarket treatments. So, you know, when you used to shop for that stain-resistant carpet, it was PFAS that caused that stain resistancy. And so eight states have now banned the use of PFAS in those applications. Six states have taken action on PFAS in cosmetics. Cosmetics in this case also includes personal care products. There was a new study out today showing that several types of deodorant contain PFAS, and those states that have passed legislation on PFAS, it would cover deodorants and soaps and other types of personal care products. And 12 states have banned the sale of PFAS that can PFAS and firefighting foam. And it's really those states that have led the way that are that's the reason that we're seeing a number of different fluorine-free foams hitting the market right now. The Department of Defense and their military specification has said that they will no longer use AFFF foam, and a number of airports are transitioning away from AFFF foam now that the FAA has come out with a fluorine-free foam that is allowed to be used. So that transitioning is now happening over time. States are also leading the way on PFAS and water standards. The previous speaker spoke about the new EPA proposed MCL for six different types of PFAS at 4 parts per trillion. But prior to that, we had 10 states who adopted some enforceable drinking water standards for certain PFAS. Delaware and Virginia are still developing. And 13 additional states, including Minnesota, adopted guidance levels or notification levels for PFAS in drinking water. As our previous speaker talked about, it's usually carbon filtration systems or other type of filtration systems, but a big question that states are trying to grapple with is what to do with those filtration systems and those carbon filters once they have been spent, once they are full. And the truth is we don't really have a good answer. A lot of times PFAS have been incinerated, and that's really why we're seeing PFAS migrate to the poles. They travel on air currents. Traditional incineration cannot destroy PFAS in the way it needs to be destroyed. There have been a number of different pilot projects to try to find ways to destroy PFAS that have been pretty promising, but so far they have not been at scale. And so a lot of states are just storing the filters until they can find a way to actually destroy PFAS. And so that's the situation that is going to quickly become untenable. States are also leading the way on PFAS accountability, and Minnesota really is at the forefront of leading the way on PFAS accountability. Currently, we have 29 state AGs who have pursued litigation against manufacturers of PFAS chemicals for contaminating water supplies and other natural resources. And the reason is a good one. As you heard from the previous speaker, billions of dollars are going to be spent in the next decade to try to remediate drinking water soil, groundwater from PFAS contamination. It's an unfortunate situation that the more we look for PFAS, the more we find. And getting PFAS out of water is not easy. It requires a lot of times new filtration systems to be built, entirely new systems to be put online. And so it's an expensive proposition to try to treat PFAS. Thus far, it's mostly been taxpayers that have been footing the bill. From our calculations, and this number is probably pretty low, Minnesota has spent over $48 million on PFAS cleanup. But as you heard from the previous speaker, that number is just going to keep going up and up and up. So what's happening in 2024? This is the map of states that either have introduced or are anticipated to introduce policies to regulate PFAS. Right now, we have 21 states who are trying to address the use of PFAS, including 16 states that are seeking broader PFAS bans. When I say broader PFAS bans, I'm really talking about policies that would ban PFAS in a number of different product categories, or would take the approach that Minnesota took with Amara's Law last year that bans the use of all currently unavoidable uses of PFAS. 10 states are looking to ban PFAS from firefighting foam and personal protective equipment. And Maryland and Virginia are looking at the industrial discharges of PFAS. Virginia, I believe the bill is on the governor's desk right now. What it would do is monitor wastewater facilities, and any abnormally high level of PFAS would then be investigated. And Maryland is using its authority under the Clean Water Act to regulate industrial discharges of PFAS. As you spoke about, there is some infrastructure funding for PFAS. The federal bipartisan infrastructure bill allocated $10 billion to states for PFAS remediation. All of the states are doing this differently. I just looked up a few examples here. Pennsylvania placed their funding into this Penn Best grant program, where localities can apply for cleanup funds. North Carolina received $230 million in grants. But I will say, you know, one district alone is spending $30 million of that $230 million grant to build a new treatment facility. So as was said earlier, this is not a cheap prospect, and likely this $10 billion is just going to be nowhere near enough. Interestingly, California is expanding monitoring, but they're also investing in developing new treatment techniques and trying to find ways to treat PFAS for cheaper and faster. So that work is really nascent. And so, there's not a lot to report on that, but we definitely need, more investigation of treatment techniques, and we definitely need more investigation of what to do with filters once they have been spent. Because, as I said, there's just not enough information on what to do with PFAS and how to get rid of it. So finally, I'll just end by saying, you know, cleanup is great, and I think everybody's really excited about the notion of cleaning up drinking water and getting PFAS out of drinking water. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's even harder to do unless you turn off the tap. So Minnesota has been a leader in this, as I said earlier. passing of the MARS law, which bans all uses of PFAS unless the MPCA determines that the use of PFAS is currently unavoidable, meaning it's necessary for health or safety or the functioning of society. We are seeing other states starting to follow suit. California just introduced similar legislation. Colorado did as well, and other states are working on similar legislation to try to emulate what Minnesota has already done. As I've said, we've seen a number of product bans, but the more we look for PFAS in water, the more we find the same is true of looking for PFAS in products. So I don't think a lot of people anticipated that PFAS was used in deodorant until that study came out today. I've recently learned that PFAS is used in some car washes. So the more we look for PFAS in products, the more we find. And so keeping up with the product bans is going to be really difficult for states to do. States are also looking at disclosure policies similar to what is in Minnesota's MARS law. Maine has a disclosure policy, and other states have introduced policies to require disclosure of PFAS and products to the state. And some states are introducing measures on accountability. The state of Vermont was the first and only state, I believe, to pass a law on requiring medical monitoring for those living near polluting facilities. And they have introduced but have not yet passed strict liability for PFAS manufacturers. Right now, that strict liability really isn't there. But in order to be able to hold those who cause the problem accountable, that might be what's needed. So that is a very quick overview of what is happening in the states. I'm going to go ahead and stop my screen share, and I can take questions. Take your questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question, Ms. Salter, is there a part of Minnesota where there is a higher concentration of PFAS? I mean, if you'd answer that, please.
Yeah. So,
Ms. Salter.
I don't know that I'm the one who can answer that question. I've not done a lot of deep dives into Minnesota and what's actually happening in the current areas. So I think probably the MPCA would be a better one to answer that question because I just don't have that information right now.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Salter. Maybe then in a more general sense, you can answer, or is it less prevalent in rural areas? What about the where we have a lot of wells? Is it more prevalent there?
So,
Ms. Salter?
Yeah, I can't speak to Minnesota specifically, but I will say the more that we look for PFAS, the more that we find. And so it's certainly going to be prevalent next to disposal facilities or manufacturing facilities that use PFAS in their manufacturing, but it does travel, and it travels in groundwater. And other states that have tested wells have found PFAS in wells. So it's not just a metro problem. It's not a rural problem. It's really everywhere. As I said, there's more than 3,000 contaminated sites across the country. The previous speaker spoke about a few of the places where there is a lot of PFAS contamination, but we are seeing PFAS in private wells. We're seeing it, you know, in groundwater. So it's kind of an everywhere problem, unfortunately.
Great, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And to our testifier, you mentioned that in North Carolina, they're taking steps with their wastewater infrastructure to create new facilities. And I'm curious what those treatment facilities, what the comparison is between what is previously in place at those facilities versus what's been upgraded and filtering and what is being done differently.
Yeah, so facility that I spoke about is Fayetteville Works, and that is located next to a Chemours facility that has been polluting the Cape Fear River with Gen X, which is a type of PFAS, and so they have a really high level of PFAS in their area. Again, I can't really speak to the exact treatment technology. I can speak to my colleagues in North Carolina and try to get you that answer. I don't have the specifications on exactly what they are doing. I just know that they are upgrading it, and that upgrade is costing $30 million.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And just one more question. You know, one of the things that we're really grappling with here in Minnesota and up in our neck of the woods is just our landfill situation. And I saw in Minnesota, the MPCA found that there's PFAS in over 59 of our landfills and over 41 of our counties in the groundwater. So I'm just curious if there's, you mentioned that there's no real scalable technology. that would destroy it. And so I'm just curious, like, if you're seeing emerging technologies or what other states are doing in terms of landfills, do you try to filter and capture the PFAS, or do you just let it be what's sort of the better option at this point?
Ms. Alder.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I am not seeing a lot of the states trying to address PFAS contamination from landfills, unfortunately. And you're absolutely right. PFAS is leaching out of landfills because it's in consumer products, and it leaches out of consumer products and into groundwater. And so, we're really, as much as we know about PFAS and the dangers of PFAS, we really are at the beginning of this journey of trying to remediate PFAS in all different kinds of media. And so right now the focus has really been on drinking water systems, but there's not been a lot of focus from what I've seen on how to clean groundwater and how to clean PFAS from landfills. Some landfills are lined, but not all are, and that lining ultimately sometimes fails. So I do think some investment does need to be made in looking at treatment technologies and looking at how to prevent PFAS leaching from landfills into groundwater. That work just hasn't really been done yet, for the most part, because we are still trying to find out where it is and where it's coming from. As I said, the more we look for PFAS, the more we find, not just in our drinking water systems, but in products. And this problem has been in the works for over 70 years, and we're right now about 7 years into trying to fix the problem, and we just haven't gotten to that point yet, unfortunately.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Representative Lee. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair. And Ms. Salter, so I just wanted to focus a little bit more around infrastructure. Can you talk about to what extent other states are funding infrastructure beyond just relying on the federal government through the bipartisan infrastructure bill?
Ms. Salter.
Yeah, thanks for that. So I am not seeing a lot of states investing in infrastructure per se beyond the bipartisan infrastructure bill. States are spending money to try to clean up PFAS. They're spending money on drinking water, but on, massive infrastructure investments like the ones that we're talking about where you're upgrading facilities, other than installing filters in key drinking water areas, we're not seeing a lot of that. And a lot of it is just because states are, they may not be in the financial position to do so. And so this money from the federal government has given them the ability to do some infrastructure updates. But as the previous speaker said, $10 billion spread over 50 states and, countless counties doesn't really go very far in the long run. So, so that's why you see a lot of AGs who are filing litigation to try to recoup some of those costs. But again, we haven't really seen a lot of new infrastructure being built beyond trying to install filters and clean up PFAS where they can.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, so, Ms. Alter, I think you mentioned Colorado in one of your presentation, and in my brief review of what's going on, my understanding is that Colorado have a fee that they're collecting that could be used for infrastructure or for PFAS remediation, and to what extent can you talk about that,
Ms. Alter?
Yeah, thank you for that. I should have mentioned that. So Colorado placed a fee on oil and gas operations to fund PFAS treatment technologies. And so that was done a couple of years ago. I want to say it was in 2021 that they passed that fee on oil and gas. And it was a fee that sunset, that will sunset, I think, after 10 years. And it goes into this PFAS remediation fund. It's being used for cleanup. It's being used to install filters at this point. And so this is kind of their way of approaching accountability because ultimately, the oil and gas industry does use a lot of PFAS. And so they did place a fee on barrels. I think it was a fee on barrels of oil that come into the state. And so, again, I can't speak to specifics of exactly what Colorado is doing. My understanding is that it's really just being used, again, to install filters and to clean up where they can.
Thank you. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, the numbers that were talked about a little bit ago regarding the landfills that are closed in Minnesota, there's actually 110 of them that are being monitored. Of them, 98 have leachate consistent with PFAS. So in Minnesota, we have a plan. It's called the
MPCA's PFAS blueprint. There's three different legs to the stool. One is to mitigate the loss, one is to monitor. We did the mitigation last year by reducing or slowing that tap. We still have to monitor, and there's still that cleanup. That's the third leg of the stool. That cleanup cost is a very expensive cost, and I would just, for all of us, you know, that were at the legislature, I would say that our constituents really shouldn't be the ones that bear the brunt when we talk about the cleanup costs, because we have 101 landfills we're being monitored for it now. It's in all of our blood. It's a problem that all of our communities that we represent have to also address as well, and I look to them as good partners in this and not people that should be held accountable so much as that they're not the ones producing this as well. They're the ones that have to process it out of their wastewater treatment plants and get that water back where it needs to go in Minnesota flowing. And so, you know, I see a variety of challenges ahead in the landscape here in Minnesota. Our cities and counties, our landfills, all of those are going to be challenged. But I still think at the end of the day, it's not our responsibility to pay for that stuff. I think it's the producers, the ones who have made billions and billions and billions of dollars off of the health impacts that all of us are feeling across the state. They've known since 1950 that this stuff can bioaccumulate in a human body. And so I think it's something that we really need to make a good on when we talk about what our constituents should or should not be on the hook for, what our cities should or should not be on the hook for.
I think following up, it's really a polluter pays model. You know, we have the producers of PFAS and the variety of chemistry in the PFAS family, but we also have people who use PFAS to make things that we may be wearing or using, things we don't even know it's being used in. And what is the cost for that cleanup? I was struck on the, Ms. Salter, on the moving of the material. I just think of what happens if a city who's got this sludge that's from the filters and it's being shipped to Ohio and the semi goes off the road or the train goes off the road. What happens to this sludge? Where's the liability? So we have this whole system of moving filtered material out and around away from us, and that cost is being borne by the public. And so we've all been on these tours, and we've heard from our communities about, well, we just need to, you know, pay for this particular cleanup. The testimony we've heard earlier is that the settlements aren't going to cover it, and the federal government's not going to cover it through the Inflation Reduction Act or the IIJA. They may help, but it's not. And this will require an extremely large wallet if the state is going to pick it up, and that's one we don't have. Ms. Salter, is there any, you know, this interstate transport, you know, I'm assuming that commerce is, you know, the Interstate Commerce Clause is there, but what protections are there for people in terms of moving of this sludge material around in terms of transportation?
That's a really good question, and I don't know that I have the resources to really answer that right now beyond not many. You know, there is the Interstate Commerce Clause, you know, but I'm reminded of the disaster in East Palestine where vinyl chloride spilled, and, you know, there was a report that came out that showed that there's a lot of vinyl chloride that's being moved across the country, but it's not just vinyl chloride, it's a number of different chemicals and, you know, contaminated sludge like this, and we just haven't really grappled with the fact that, you know, we have toxic material that's moving through this country all the time, and communities are at risk. And so beyond, you know, a lawsuit, there's really not a lot of a lot of protection. And those lawsuits, as you've heard, are very long. They're very slow, and often they don't end up with the result that's necessary. So, you know, if I may be so bold as to say that we need investment in treatment technologies as soon as possible. We need investment in finding ways to destroy PFAS as soon as possible. As Representative Brand said, Minnesota has been a global leader in trying to prevent more PFAS exposure with the MARA's law. That is going to take some time to settle in and to be implemented. But Minnesota has a chance to really unfortunately, should be a global leader again to find some new treatment technologies. And I realize that funding is not necessarily readily available, but to be able to be a global leader on PFAS, as you have been, to invest in treatment technologies, to invest in PFAS destruction technologies, would be a boon, not just for Minnesotans, but for the rest of the country.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chairs. Yesterday, I was privileged to be in a meeting with Resource Recovery over at the Capitol in room 316, and the discussion table went around, and one of the points that Xcel Energy, there's a plant in Red Wing that burns garbage. They have successfully burned the PFAS at 1,000 degrees centigrade. That they came out yesterday public with it. I don't know, they haven't officially done a rollout, but I feel compelled to talk about it because I heard it. I can't prove it. I just know that they were very confident, 99.9% they were burning. It's about 1,800 degrees. And when I brought up what we're doing in St. Louis County, trying to get capital investment money to build a to take all the landfills, the old landfills, and put them in a concentrated area to get the PFAS out of the ground there, put it in a area, and then we can manage those PFAS. My question to them was, can we burn just the PFAS, or does it have to be sprinkled amongst the garbage to burn it to get to eradicate them? And they didn't know right now. They know that they can successfully take my shirt, which I was wearing that had PFAS in it, and I'm like, who? You know, but he said they are doing that now. And it's new technology that's coming out. So I think we're going in the right direction. I like Representative Brand, think it's something we need to get on right now. In the sense that we know that it's in our landfills, our old landfills. We know it's going through our water system. If we can get what we're trying to do on the Iron Range, take these things and put them into a concentrated area to concentrate the PFAS, if we can find a way to manage them once we get them out of the environment, that's going to help us make the decisions to go forward. So I think there's technology out there. I don't know how much money we have to spend on to use that technology, but I'm more concerned about getting the PFAS out of the ground right now so that they're not radicals.
Ms. Salter, any response?
Yes, so that is a new, as you said, you just heard about it yesterday, and this is something new, so I've not really had a chance to investigate it. I know that traditional incineration does not destroy PFAS. I think some of the challenges with incineration in general is that while PFAS may be able to be destroyed, there may be a number of other harmful chemicals that are released in that process. Incineration generally is not really the best answer for the environment writ large or the communities that are living next to it. So the pilot treatment technologies that I discussed earlier were really very novel approaches to PFAS that did not include incineration. So something like certain kinds of bacteria that may be able to eat it or other types of technologies that don't include incineration. So it may be good to look at I'd be interested to see that report and to confer with my scientists to see what they think about it. But ultimately, I think incineration might be something that should be avoided just for not just because we're not looking to just destroy PFAS, but there may be a number of unintended consequences that can come with incineration.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. One of the questions that was asked, so what is the byproduct of that? And they believe that they're catching all of it. The stack was still clean on the outside, you know, when they're measuring the pollutants. So, again, I'm not even going to claim to be part of an expert. It's just what I heard, and it's 99.99% that they're getting out of the environment. they could go to 99.999999, but they don't have the technology to measure that far. So that's what we were told yesterday. Thank you. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franson, and then we'll move on to the next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to Ms. Seltzer, just a question here. I'm looking on a website from American Chemistry Council, PFAS, critical to renewable energy. We know that recycling of wind turbines is a relatively newer concept. Is she even on?
She's on.
Oh, okay. As a relatively newer concept, companies are coming up with innovative ways to use the turbines. However, we do have thousands and thousands of turbines across this country that have been buried in landfills. My question is, has there been any water testing in those areas and or soil testing to see how much of that is leaking into our water supply?
Ms. Alder.
Thank you for that question. I unfortunately don't have enough information on that. I haven't seen anything specific, but again, I don't purport to know everything that's happening in the world of PFAS. What I can say, though, that is, you know, in regard to the website that you mentioned, I don't think we need to choose either or when it comes to climate or toxicity. And I think that that's a false choice that's being presented to us by those who continue to make and to use PFAS, saying that we need PFAS in order to address our climate challenges. I don't think that that is true. There are a number of different alternatives that can be used in where PFAS is currently being used. And if those technologies, you know, may not be up to scale or may not be ready, I don't think we should be giving them a pass because they might be useful in some climate applications. Certainly, I think the quest for safer alternatives, even when PFAS is used in a low carbon you know, heat pump or in a wind turbine, alternatives either are available or should be made available so that we don't have to make that false choice between climate and public health.
Representative Franson. We'll move to the next presentation. Thank you, Ms. Seltzer. This is a Michigan perspective on PFAS. Abigail Hendershot, Executive Director of the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team and the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. So that's the Action Response Team for the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. Welcome via Zoom.
All right. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Proceed.
Okay. Excellent. Let me go ahead and share my screen then. All right. And I'm happy to share the slides with you after we are done here so that you can, and let me just put it into presentation mode. There we go. All right. I'm assuming you can see my screen all right?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So thank you today for having me and inviting me to be part of this discussion on PFAS. My name is Abby Hendershot. I'm the Executive Director for the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, what we call MPART, here in the state of Michigan. I'm just going to run through real basics of what MPART is, our collaboration structure, because it really plays into the discussion on funding and looking forward. And I will just mention that as in my role, I've been very closely working with your Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on a wide variety of PFAS topics. So we've got a lot of familiarity. So in Michigan, in 2017, MPART was actually started as an executive directive. We realized at that point that PFAS played a direct risk to the public health of the state. And so MPART was created to address that risk. So it is actually now been made as an enduring body under an executive order by Governor Whitmer. This is a one-of-a-kind, unique multi-agency approach. So we've got seven different departments that I help to coordinate on all things PFAS. It helps to coordinate the state's strategy on PFAS, and it leads to that coordination not only for state government, but also local and federal responses to PFAS in the state of Michigan. So our coordination structure looks like this. You don't have to know to even see the slides. Just know that MPART body itself, there's only like four of us that actually are considered to be part of MPART. Everybody else that I'm going to talk about in all the work that we have done are about 400 different staff that have some piece or part of the PFAS work that we're doing. They're all embedded in the departments. And so most of the work that I'm going to talk about here is actually done in our departments around PFAS. So MPART does a really good job, and the reason my job is really about coordination and collaboration. MPART doesn't actually set policies. Those are done within the departments, but we help to coordinate all of the strategies around PFAS. So obviously, MDOT is our Department of Transportation. They have all the airports. And so obviously PFAS is a big deal for airports, our Fish and Wildlife with DNR, Department of Agriculture with MDARD, our commercial food supply is a big deal. We put local public health in there because they are usually our boots on the ground for talking about public health. Department of Military and Veterans Affairs has all of our military sites. Department of Health and Human Services, obviously, is our health partners. Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. And then LARA houses our state fire marshals. So everybody's got a little piece at the table in this structure. Because it has, we have my position as leading the team has really leveraged all of the resources that Michigan has put into the PFAS effort to really make Michigan one of the leaders around PFAS. We've really done most of this work that I'm going to talk about here in the last since the end of 2017. So our approach to PFAS has been, we're gonna use the science. We're gonna make sure we get the data to try to understand the sites. We're making sure that we protect public health through all of our investigations, protecting on the side of extreme caution, and then we're identifying those sites and reducing those sources. I'm gonna talk about that a little bit. A lot of source control has gone on. We've been able to identify where we've got industries actually leaking into our wastewater treatment plants, so the wastewater treatment plants don't have to actually put on treatment. We're making sure the industries that are discharging are actually putting on those treatments instead of the wastewater treatment plants. And where we can identify a responsible party, we are trying to use the law, as you guys are as well, to require actions to reduce those concentrations of PFAS. Everybody's heard and seen the PFAS cycle. I don't really have to go through this too much with you guys because I think you've talked about it already today. But obviously, a lot of our infrastructure work is around wastewater treatment plants. What we've done in Michigan is kind of turn that, and we've done a lot of sampling of wastewater treatment plants, sampling of drinking water plants. And so we can tell where which of those plants are having issues, and then we work with them to identify those sources that are getting into their wastewater treatment plants. So most of our wastewater treatment plants are not actually adapting any kind of treatment at their plants for PFAS. They're actually cutting off those sources upstream, and those industries are putting on the treatment, which is where we think that it should be done. That includes our landfills. A lot of our landfills are working on leachate treatment, and we've done a lot of biosolids sampling in the state of Michigan, and so we've seen those biosolids concentrations come down over time to the point now where we don't think we've got issues with biosolids in Michigan, the current biosolids, of course, because those concentrations have come down so much through addressing the sources, right at their locations instead of later at the wastewater treatment plants. Obviously, all of this works to protect public health and make sure that that our taxpayers aren't having to pay for things that really should be taken care of with the industries. So what this means in Michigan is since 2017, when we started doing this work, we've identified 278 different PFAS sites. Those are sites that have groundwater contamination above our state criteria and are a source of PFAS. They're either a landfill. We're going to talk about the different types here in a second, but they are on our website. We've also done at least 2,000 samples of surface water. All of our public water supplies are sampled on a routine basis. They're all required by the state of Michigan and the implementation of our MCLs. And then we've been doing thousands and thousands of fish samples. And all of that data is on our GIS system. So if you're interested, you can click on any of those points and see the information there. As I said, Michigan does have standards. We do have our own MCLs and our own groundwater cleanup criteria, which is the green box here for seven different compounds in the state of Michigan. We set MCLs back in 2020 when it was clear that we were not going to get federal standards very quickly. Still don't have federal standards, as you know. And so these are both are enforceable for both municipal systems and for those sites where they've got groundwater groundwater plumes that are above criteria. We can ask them to clean up to these standards. We also have surface water standards. So if we've got, you know, direct discharges into surface water, they have to be able to meet these standards, especially if they are, if that surface water, being the Great Lakes state, we have a lot of our communities that take water right out of the lakes for drinking water source. And so if somebody's discharging near one of those sources, they would have to meet these lower standards that is protective for human health. The types of sites that we've identified, we've gone through and prioritized our landfills. We have probably 250 solid waste landfills that we know of, but there are thousands of little township dumps that are unlined, uncapped, and not monitored that potentially all have PFAS as well. The landfills here you'll see in red make up the biggest piece of this pie. They aren't necessarily the highest concentrations, though. I will mention that when it comes to highest concentrations of PFAS that we find, it is usually from the plating facilities and or the chemical facilities. So those are going to have the highest concentrations. They just don't make up as big of a piece of this pie. Airports, obviously, almost all of our airports that have any kind of history with firefighting foam have PFAS contamination. Our military sites for the same reason. Wastewater treatment plants, we have a car wash, a school. Those are all less of a concentrated source. They do have exceedances, but they're not a very high concentration sources. Paper manufacturing, refineries, tanneries. Tanneries can be very high concentration sources. We just don't have as many of them. And then hazardous waste and power stations. So let's talk about funding. That's what you guys specifically wanted to know from this request to Michigan, is how did we fund our work? And I will say, as I was going back and trying to put this presentation together for you, a lot of the funds, the seed money, so to speak, in 2017 came as direct appropriations from the state legislature. They were very generous in recognizing the immediate public health concern. And so we had funds that were being spent directly out of state budgets, as well as general funds, remediation funds, and direct appropriations that came. Once we got things rolling, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the things that we were doing. Once we got those things rolling in 2017, 18, 19, then, you know, we came into some of the American Rescue Plan funds, the ARPA funds, the bipartisan infrastructure legislation, the bill funds, and there was emerging contaminants, the EC emerging contaminant funds under bill that was available, and EPA's now got some emerging contaminants and small disadvantaged community funds that we're also using. For loans and grants, obviously, we were going and using our drinking water state revolving funds and our clean water state revolving funds. And then we did direct appropriations. We have a fund called C2R2, and I'll talk about here in the next slide, that we did take some state dollars and some federal dollars and made that work for a number of communities. So when we started in 2017, and it was really the end of 2017 that we established MPART, and then in January of the next year got our first set of cleanup criteria on the books that were enforceable. In FY18, we started sampling all of our public water supplies. We needed to know what we had going on. So we started sampling public water supplies as phase one. We started sampling 95 of our wastewater treatment plants and testing biosolids. We started a pickup and collection of AFFF program. But all of that was done with state funds because we just didn't, you know, there were no federal funds at that point and we knew it needed to be done. FY19, we continued doing statewide public water sampling our landfills, starting to sample some of our hazardous waste sites. We started doing a few drinking water SRF loans that were given out to four different communities at that point. But about FY20, we started doing a fund that we called our Consolidation and Contamination Risk Reduction, so affectionately named C2R2, which was a $25 million of direct appropriation from the legislature, plus later on, I think in FY22, we ended up adding in another $18 million from the American Rescue Plan funds for PFAS. That ultimately funded municipal water extensions for 13 different communities that were affected by PFAS. So that was a huge start of trying to get a good inventory of those communities that were affected by PFAS and who was gonna need what, which communities were gonna have a future need for PFAS infrastructure or PFAS municipal water extensions because of the PFAS contamination being found in their groundwater. We continued on with doing AFFF pickup and from fire stations, we were still doing a lot of fish and deer sampling. So a lot of, you know, the ongoing state investment was still there, but we started to add in a lot of this federal funds as well. So for FY21, again, same things that we were always doing, continuing on with public water investigations, public health sites, or identifying sites in all of our different categories. But on top of that, then we added in about six different drinking water infrastructure loans and grants, about $16.9 million in drinking water SRF funds. We had one loan specifically to a community for $1.48 through a drinking water SRF. And then we did a state direct appropriation for the airports. So we gave grants. We had a $4 million pot of money that was a direct appropriation so that the airports, all 19, 20 of them, could apply for about $300,000 apiece to start doing investigation work at the airports to understand, you know, where was the contamination on their site? Was it leaving the site? Was there any drinking water wells at risk? We had gone and done proactive sampling around most of those airports to make sure that nobody was drinking the contamination because we did have a few instances of that in the state. But then this additional money was to help the airports continue on with that investigation work. FY22, we continue on with doing, using more of the C2R2 funds, the finishing up the ARPA funds. We had general funds that were awarded for some PFAS work, and that was all totaling $29 million. And then FY23, we had, and I believe these were drinking water, or it was all being run through the drinking water program of $28.8 million. For another three or four different communities that are getting infrastructure funds. And we've got a long list. I think we're gonna spend all of our bill emerging contaminant funds for FY24 and 25. We're expecting the next 2 years to get some additional funds through the bill emerging contaminants. And we've got money set aside. Let me go, I'm getting ahead of myself. So we've got money set aside here from our EPA emerging contaminants, small disadvantaged community grants. Michigan applied for that funding. It's a 5 years worth of funding. So years one and two came and we ended up with $38 million. So we're using that for helping out a couple of communities with some pretty big projects, and then doing some investigation funding of, or investigation of some particular areas of smaller and disadvantaged communities where not everybody in the community is hooked up to municipal water, and we think there's probably PFAS sources in their area. So we're going and sampling drinking water wells and then going to get those people hooked up to municipal water so that the cities are, the small and disadvantaged communities are taken care of. So we're looking for opportunities like that where we can take that funding and start using it for some of our communities around the state. There are is at least one community, they got an EPA grant or for agricultural investigations. We know there's another community that got a USDA rural development loan for municipal water infrastructure work. And I know they've got a water and waste disposal loan and grant program as well. So we're continuing to work on those. This is just a screenshot of those, the emerging contaminants, small and disadvantaged communities grants through EPA, and then the bioaccumulation plan uptake for agricultural sites. I think it's important to be holistic in our approach because this isn't just about drinking water plants or just about landfills or just about wastewater plants. We've got sites out there that are all kinds of different shapes and sizes when it comes. We usually think about cleanup and contamination sites being around industries or being around, you know, large cities. That is not necessarily going to be the case. And it could be in our rural communities that really will not have a drinking water source or be able to ever afford their own drinking water plant. So we've got to understand what the broad implications that are of that. And so we're trying to do that in Michigan. I will just put a quick blurb up here about our website. We have a ton of information on our website if you want more information. And we put out a fiscal year fast facts every year. It doesn't have the kind of information you guys were asking for the funding, but it is a pretty good overview of every year of what we accomplished in the last fiscal year. So we've been doing that for the last 5 years. So there's information out on site, on online, if you wanted to take a look at that. And we've got information on resources for residents. So for Gretchen, who was just talking, I will just point out to her that we probably got her website on here. Our resources for residents has a link for people to be able to search for PFAS-free products. And we're using websites like hers to direct people to those resources that are out there online that actually do the research around what's a PFAS-free product. So ton of information there. And I think I'm ready for questions if you guys are ready to ask.
Thank you, Director.
Unless you want me to go back.
Members, any questions? I do want to note that we will have 7 minutes since the Environment Committee will have to transition to their committee hearing time. Chair Hansen.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has Michigan done any work looking at the synergistic effect of PFAS found in water or air along with other contaminants or, let's say, nitrates or pesticides or other lead, any other type of contaminant has there been any research on the health side of impacts on synergy of these various contaminants?
Director.
Yeah, no, we have not done any, I've not seen any research like that on the synergistic effects of other contaminants. What we are looking at is just the basics of the synergistic effects of the total PFAS loading, because often, you know, we talk about individual substances, but often PFAS comes as a mixture. As we know with firefighting foam, it's not just one compound. So there is research going on that front. It's not being done within Michigan, but we are watching a lot of what DOD research is being. DOD sponsors a ton of research, and so we're watching a lot of that to see what the toxicity of mixtures, they call it, for PFAS is going to yield, because I do think there's going to be some additional information on that front.
Thank you, Director. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. And Director, really appreciate your covering rural communities and then also tribal communities up there in the presentation. I'm really interested in the interaction between tribal governments. I see on this map they're not specifically listed, the 12 tribal nations in Michigan, but just checking and seeing they're a part of your working group with the governments, and wondering if you can talk about that interaction of the tribal nations, but then also the funding with perhaps the small and disadvantaged communities. We know that tribal nations are impacted with our lifeways, our resources, and cultural activities and our traditional foods, but we are so often left behind in the federal research that's been done in the evaluation. You know, EPA, there's a lot of data that shows that tribal nations have been less studied and evaluated and monitored. And so if you could just speak to the remediation and then that relationship with tribes would be really helpful.
Director.
Yes. For the tribes, I will say that tribes are invited to all of our, we have, for every new site that we add to our MPART website, we do a local officials calls. And so tribes are always invited. They don't always participate. Where we do get a lot of participation is with our fish monitoring, obviously. They're very interested and get regular downloads from us on our fish monitoring and any kind of information in and around their tribal areas that they're concerned about. So we do have regular touch points with them. We do have a tribal coordinator within our department who regularly gets involved, and then I've been to a couple of their meetings as well. So I would say it's not as robust of a conversation as I would like to have, but I think it's more from the research side on their side of being having people to be able to attend the meetings and getting the interaction. As far as the funding, I think we've been doing some research that helps benefit them, but we've not done any collaborative research necessarily with the tribes. But there is quite a bit, I know, in the fish and wildlife arena. I'm seeing a lot of information from EPA and from different tribal nations on work that's being done in those arenas. But MPART hasn't had, you know, a lot to do with those pieces of it. Did that answer all your questions?
Representative Kozlowski, quick follow-up, and then Representative Ving, and then we'll be done.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lee and Director. And I think this just echoes, reinforces how important it is that we provide those supports in that capacity for whether it's disadvantaged communities or tribal nations to participate and make sure that we're mitigating this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Ving, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this quick. Director, if I'm just looking at the funding that you guys have. I'm wondering if you guys are spending on anything related within agriculture or if there's grants within that.
Director.
Whoops. Can you say that again? I got a little blurb on my, or a little
Yeah, that's
wasn't
okay.
Clear to me.
So my question is, I was just looking at the funding that you guys have spent on PFAS and wondering if there's any in agriculture and if there's any spending in grants in that too.
Director.
Yes, we are. The agricultural piece is pretty big to us. We have spent money within the departments investigating a couple of different farms in our state. And so there has just recently been a grant awarded from our Department of Agriculture to Michigan State University to do some agricultural studies on one of the contaminated farms to look at crop uptake, look at, you know, the overall toxicity and see if there's any kind of remediation that might be able to be developed around sequestration or stabilization of PFAS in soils. And so that work has started, and we haven't gotten very far into it, but yeah, definitely funds have been used, not federal funds. This is all, again, state funds. And so state of Michigan's put in a lot of money, of our own money, in the PFAS effort. We don't have a PFAS manufacturer in the state, and we don't have any fees that are necessarily being leveraged against any of the, you know, PFAS manufacturers or PFAS users. So we've been doing it from direct appropriations and hoping to get it back in other ways.
Thank you, Director. And Chair Vang, I encourage you to look about bringing some of these testifiers to your committee, too, so that we can have a more in-depth conversation around your piece. Members, and I just want to say thank you all for coming by for the joint hearing and for all of our testifiers from the AG's office and from our two national counterparts. With that, at this point, the Capital Investment Committee of this joint hearing will be adjourned, and then I will turn it over to Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee will recess and will reconvene at 3:45 p.m. in Room 10 of the State Office Building. Thank you. We are in recess.